The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. Happy New Year and happy 1% Day, where third-party cookies have been phased out for that diddly proportion of Chrome users. We're now into the 11th hour of the original identifier. How things will play out, only time will tell, but naturally we'll be discussing it in further Mad Tech Podcast episodes throughout the year. Now, I'm delighted to be starting the year with not one but two stalwarts of the ExchangeWire content team. Firstly, we have Mariam Ahmed, editorial lead.
Hi, Matt. Great to be here for our in-person podcast, which is always exciting. Yeah,
it's an absolute thrill. And John Still, head of content. Hello to you, John.
Hi, Matt. Happy New Year. And yeah, delighted to be in the office with you guys.
Absolute thrill, absolute hoot. We'll start off with our first news story of the week, and that's that last week, Amazon announced that it will be introducing ads to its Prime Video service. Ads will be arriving first to users in the US and Canada on the 29th of January, while users in the UK and Germany will see ads from the 5th of February, before a rollout to other markets throughout 2024. To avoid seeing ads, UK customers will have to pay an additional £2.99 per month, while US customers will have to pay $2.99 a month. So my first question to you guys is, how could Amazon's ad tier potentially compare to that of Disney Plus and Netflix? John, let's start with you.
It's an interesting differentiation on the model, I think. You know, we're seeing more is less versus less is more in terms of what they're charging, and I think it's fascinating. This is going to be a huge year in terms of the streaming wars, and it's not really a surprise to see Amazon jumping in with both feet at the start of the year. But I think, yeah, it's... they could be onto a winner here in terms of just general customer inertia to come at you with a base level of like, you will be receiving ads unless you pay more, rather than if you pay less, then you can have an ad supported service. I think they might really corner a market with people who just don't want to add more on their subscription and get the ads. So they, in terms of an ad provider, they could come out champion here. I think it's a really interesting move. I won't be adding money onto my subscription to remove ads, so I'll tolerate the ads. I think a lot of people have the same frame of mind as me. They would take action to reduce their costs, but not take action to add on costs to remove the ads. I think there'll be a lot of tolerance of them. So in terms of where that ad spend goes, this could be a bold move from Amazon, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Mariam, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, just echoing what John said there, I think it's safe to say that we're sort of witnessing an ad-supported streaming war at this point. And the competition's really heating up. This is the first time that we've seen multiple players within the same space. You know, Disney's Hulu, now Amazon. And I read, in terms of comparability, I read that in a separate article that they're going to add on, Amazon is 115 of million of their Prime users onto this ad tier supported streaming service. So, you know, they're in the big league straight away. It's not starting off with small numbers. So yeah, in terms of comparability, like I mentioned, definitely comparable, and it's Amazon at the end of the day. So like John mentioned, I think they're off to a really, really, you know, big start.
Yeah, interesting. I think in terms of why they've gone in rather than introducing a cheaper tier, it's that they've already got obviously the logistics side of things. They've got, you know, audio services such as podcasting. So I think that's why they've taken that decision to go in without introducing a lower price tier. But how well that plays out with obviously Netflix and Disney Plus attracting more users to their cheaper tier, it's going to be interesting to see. Like John, you said, you're not going to pay. I don't think I'm going to pay an extra £3 because obviously that tier could always go up, as we've seen Netflix doing with their premium tiers. So yeah, that'll be an interesting to see how quickly users adopt that higher tier. But what do you guys make of the Amazon statement that the service will have meaningfully fewer ads than linear and other streaming providers? John? we had a little pre-discussion on this one, and I think John's answer is going to be fairly equivocal.
I'm sure they believe it's true now. If maybe they believe into the very fibre of their being that they will be showing meaningfully fewer ads, time will absolutely tell. We had Reed Hastings 3 years ago saying that Netflix would always be a safe respite from the advertising industry. And look at Netflix now with their lower priced advertising tier. I imagine it will go the same way anything else does. They'll start seeing the benefits of it, and they will start sneaking in more ads. You know, there'll be two pre-rolls rather than one pre-roll. There will be mid-credits. It will sneak up. So they might believe it, and it might be a nice line for them now to say meaningly fewer. But but I doubt it stays the course.
Yeah, fair enough. Mariam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the wording is really interesting, meaningly fewer ads. Obviously, if we were to read between the lines here, I think what's implied is that they're trying to ensure that the amount of ads won't be an annoyance to viewers, you know, so trying to maintain somewhat of a good viewing experience in comparison to linear TV, for example, or other TV streaming services. Yeah, I think by not to be an Amazon advocate here, I don't think any of us are, but by promising fewer ads, I think they're potentially, you know, aiming to attract viewers, you know, who do want to maintain that high viewing experience. So yeah, it's going to be a bit of a balancing act for them to try and achieve what they deem to be a decent amount of ads while also trying to cater to viewers. But I echo what John says there. I think it's wishful thinking. It'll be interesting to see if they maintain that, if at all. I doubt it. But yeah, this one will be interesting to watch unfold.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how the, you know, verbal gymnastics will go as soon as they start raising the amount of ads as to what meaningful actually means for Amazon. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see that one. My final question on this one is, are continued price increases across streaming providers sustainable from both a consumer and advertiser perspective? John?
No, from the consumer perspective, it's like this fragmentation across CTV, and we're seeing, you know, the premium services are hiking prices. Disney's now a level £4 more, might have to cut this out, but £4 more than it was a couple of years ago. And customers can't take it. Like, it's the pockets being hit. There is a lot of premium TV out there. There is, you know, a great choice of services, but adding price on constantly isn't, yeah, it's, I don't see customers being able to pay for all the services that they're being asked to pay more and more for at the moment. So consumer side is interesting. Conversely, from the advertiser side, paying less for ad supported tiers offers access for advertisers to more premium inventory. You know, it offers more opportunities for them to get involved in a wider audience. So maybe the lower price tier services are going to be of benefit to the advertising industry. They'll get more eyeballs on them.
Yeah, Mariam, how do you see that balance being struck?
I think the answer to this sort of like hinges on several factors. So my mind went straight to what's consumers' willingness to pay being a major one. Subscription fatigue is a real thing. And in the article, I think it mentioned that one of Amazon's justifications for introducing an ad-supported tier was to allow for higher quality content. And, you know, let's not downplay the perceptiveness of consumers here. They will be on the outlook for that good content if they've been promised it. From the perspective of the advertiser, they're going to have to sort of maintain competitive prices amongst the competition. That's going to be something they're going to be looking out for, definitely. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with that. And I think while, you know, Amazon does offer that scale for advertisers, we're now potentially entering the age of a cable 2.0 scenario where prices are just going up and up, more fragmentation's going up in terms of the TV shows and movies people want to watch. And we've done some recent analysis at Exchange Wire looking into public companies and their recent financial results. And a worryingly large proportion of those TV platforms were stating that there's a revenue shortfall, for example, as a result of it not being US election year. Now we're in that year, it's kind of raises the question, if your revenue and bottom line is so reliant on there being a, you know, battle between octogenarians, how sustainable is your business model? So yeah, it's going to be a hugely interesting space going forward. But we will move on to our second news story of the week now, and that's that the New York Times has filed a lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft for copyright infringement over the use of its content to train generative AI and large language model systems. The lawsuit calls on the companies to destroy any chatbot models and training data which uses copyrighted material from the Times, and while it does not contain a monetary claim, it states that both parties should be held responsible for billions of dollars in statutory and actual damages. So my first question to you guys on this one is, with the lawsuits against OpenAI stacking up, how will they be forced to change their systems, if at all, and should government regulation be fast-tracked here? Mariam, let's start with you.
Yeah, a line that really stood out to me in this article was without permission or payment. But I will say, I can see it from the perspective, and this is one of those rare cases where I don't actually take a hard stance. Like, I can see it from the perspective of both sides. So from the perspective of OpenAI, at first I was like, oh, why don't they just accredit all the information that, you know, that they produce or replicate or whatever you call it? But they can't. It would mean retraining their entire models, which obviously poses an issue to the developers. From the perspective of news publishers, someone else is using your work and not giving you credit. So I can see how it's a bit of a tricky one. And I'm actually not going to take a full stance on this one because, you know, I can see how cons come with either perspective. But that being said, I think moving forward, especially given things like the EU AI Act, which actually mentions issues to do with copyright and trademark, I think in the future, this will be considered into the implementation and creation of AI. So until then, it will be interesting to see how this plays out. But I'm not quite sure how they're going to be able to wriggle themselves out of this one.
Interesting. John, what do you think on this one?
Money is probably my answer to this question, is how this will be resolved. I think the legal side of it's really interesting, and I'm pleased to see the New York Times taking a stance. I do come at it from the journalistic point of view of, you know, this is people's work, this is people's livelihoods, this is paid for, well-sourced information, one of the most trusted newspapers on the planet, and they should take a stance against their work being essentially copied, scraped, copied. And so, yeah, that side of it, it's good to see the publishing industry thinking about these things. In terms of how the lawsuit will go, I'm not sure. You know, we had Viacom versus YouTube back in the early 2000s, and that didn't go well for Viacom in the end. That was thrown out. So I imagine we're looking at licensing deals, not laws here. I don't think the regulation will come in to ban it or for them to close down the machines. That horse has well and truly bolted, but it will be favorable terms for publishers who get on board. Axel Springer recently have done the deal with OpenAI to be able to use their material, and they will get, I think it, you know, the figures reported were in the tens of millions per year for the use of that content. So I think that's probably the way the industry is going to go. Partnerships, deals, publishers getting on board and getting mutual benefits from OpenAI and their chatbots in terms of their new sourcing and creation will be interesting. Faustian pacts with the OpenAI systems.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. I'm glad you flagged that Axel Springer deal, because it's interesting to see how they've gone with, oh yeah, we'll welcome you with open arms, and then obviously New York Times going, no, actually not, you've scraped our content. And they would have, you know, let's be honest, OpenAI with the systems they've got likely have already taken data on the Axel Springer side. It's just Axel Springer's now getting rewarded for it. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that environment plays out and whether we'll continue to see that kind of divergence of some publishers taking legal action against OpenAI and some being welcoming with open arms. But yeah, I think in terms of the legislation side of things, my kind of worry is that if legislation isn't brought up to speed quickly, any lawsuits that may be dismissed at this point, or say the New York Times loses this one at this point, it then reduces their ability in future, once the laws are in place, to be able to pursue those lawsuits. So yeah, I think the regulation side of things is coming, but it's quite slow. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Just to add fuel to the trademark fire, ooh, I played around with DALL-E, which is the text-to-image sort of creation tool, I guess you would call it, on ChatGPT. And if you give it really vague prompts, like video game Italian or animated sponge, you get pictures. You get pictures of Mario and you get pictures of SpongeBob. So, you know, it's not looking good in terms of copyright and trade. Because where does that, you know, where do they stand with that? Because those are obviously trademarked figures. And, you know, it's across the board on ChatGPT. So it's really interesting. It's not just the New York Times. It's not just news publishers. It's seemingly everyone. That was just an interesting point I thought I would mention.
Yeah, and it goes back to that licensing thing. That's the only way I can see it coming, because, you know, there's the line about New York Times are asking for the machines to be shut down. Like, we're going to be in accusations of Luddite territory. You know, OpenAI, they're going to be saying, this is the future. We're standing in the way of progress. This
exactly.
is like... age old, from Napster to Spotify through to YouTube, the copyright side of things, it's playing out again on a very advanced, very quick scale. So all I can see is, you know, like you say, like, I love that, just animated sponge type.
it's my favourite TV show as a child, Sponge Robert, the animated sponge, and his rectangular trousers.
But that'll soon become, they'll pick their side, whichever, whether it's Microsoft Bing Create, whether it's OpenAI, whether it's DALL-E, like all of a sudden, like the image of that particular Italian game character, or that particular sponge.
I wonder whom he is talking about.
Or that blue hedgehog. They will be, they'll have a company that they side with, and the deals will be inked, I think.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can balance like the future thinking and the joy of the technology versus like stealing people's work.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Looking in terms of how, you know, generative AI is being an integrated lot into search engines currently. How will the publisher relationships with those search engines evolve as generative AI is further integrated here? John?
We had this discussion, a decade or so back, when news publishers were terrified of what Facebook and Google were going to mean for their, you know, for their work, and how quickly people could access the information off their sites and how revenue was being diverted. We had inventions like Google AMP, like advanced mobile pages, where you could read The Guardian, credited to The Guardian, for example, on Google. But it does have the potential to massively change search, and publishers will have to adapt, I think, to that. There will be, again, deals made. There will be advances made in how information is surfaced, but yeah, in terms of what it offers and what the AI systems offer, it could really adapt how search works, how information is uncovered, and publishers will have to adapt.
Yeah, absolutely. Mariam, how do you see that relationship evolving?
Yeah, for me, the main thing that stands out is just traffic, and obviously heightened traffic equals, you know, ad revenues, and vice versa for the opposite scenario. So my guess would be news publishers are most fearful of that. If users can get sufficient information from AI tools, why would they go to the news publishers? That being said, I mean, the numbers of that ChatGPT sort of has, I think it's 100 million a week or something, something crazy. So I think that's going to cause a few issues and bumps down the road in terms of that relationship, because, you know, let's be honest, traffic is everything for news publishers. It's how they justify numbers to, you know, ads and all that sort of thing. So definitely interested to see how this one will play out.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that referral traffic will, it's going to be hugely effective if it does play out as expected with that integration. And I expect to see more tie-ups of the likes of New York Times buying Wordle, just to kind of build that additional source of audience that they wouldn't necessarily get from people just typing in to their search engine about news stories. So yeah, it's going to be, again, a hugely interesting one to see how it all plays out, and whether we'll see those, you know, the lawsuits versus the partnerships, that dichotomy, how that plays out going forward. We're going to move on to our final news story of the week now, and that's that the UK government will be exerting more control over the e-commerce market, with a new policy requiring second-hand goods platforms, as well as short-term home letting firms such as Airbnb, to report user earnings to HM Revenue and Customs. The policy's purpose is to collect tax revenue and income from used goods sold on platforms such as eBay, Amazon and Depop. Sellers making over £1,000 per year are currently considered self-employed and need to file a return to the UK Tax Authority. So my first question to you guys is, how will the new rules affect e-commerce within the UK and in turn retail media efforts on these second-hand goods platforms? John?
I'm not sure. I don't know where to sit on this. Initially, when I saw the news, I wanted to be outraged and say, this is hugely annoying. You know, why should I be taxed on selling goods for less than I paid for them that I'd already been taxed on when I'm selling old stuff to buy new stuff? I mean, it's just adding more friction and more problems for people who want to sell on those platforms and could be quite, you know, like people pay their tax, but it's could potentially be off-putting and therefore a lower set of eyes for advertisers, for retail media. I'm still chewing this one over because I'm not quite sure what side to, how to feel about it.
Mariam, what are your thoughts on this one?
I'm pissed from a personal perspective because I use Vinted and, you know, but taking myself out of it, it does, I think even the article that talked about this mentioned it was called a side hustle tax, which the wording is just so unfair. You know, my mind immediately goes to the fact that I think this could discourage like small time sellers or casual sellers, you know, which could ultimately like alter the dynamics of the secondhand goods market in the UK, because obviously this is where it's applicable to. From a retail media perspective, though, obviously what this means for the platforms is they're going to have to sort of increase their like administrative costs to do with like VAT, you know, rules or whatever you may call it. And I think, and I guess the fear with that would be costs would sort of be like diverted away from advertising and marketing efforts towards that. So what does this mean? I don't really know. But my mind also goes to the fact that how are they going to try and retarget these audiences? The only way that I can think is through data. That brings up privacy concerns and, you know, what the industry is talking about right now is, you know, death third-party cookies, all that sort of thing. There's so many concerns with this. I don't really know how this is going to work out for the consumer and ultimately for the advertiser. It could go many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll play a little bit of devil's advocate to your I'm pissed stance in the sense that if, you know, these rules in terms of the £1,000 per year limit before you have to file a tax return, that's already in place before, you know, this legislation's brought in to make the secondhand platforms report that amount. So it should, in theory, reduce the level of fraudsters on these platforms, which should in turn raise the quality of goods on these platforms and allow more space for the ordinary ordinary seller to be able to sell without having to vie against sellers who aren't, you know, paying their tax obligations. But you know, I completely agree with you. It could go completely the other way and could really, you know, put people off selling on these platforms, which obviously would in turn lower the scale of them from the advertising perspective. How will these rules impact platforms that don't directly facilitate the sales, such as the classified websites, such as Gumtree and Facebook Marketplace? John?
I actually just want to pick up on your last point there, because that's what I was trying to say when I wasn't sure what side to fall down on, because that's the side, you know, that there are benefits here. And my question is, why has it been communicated so poorly?
Yeah.
Why are we getting phrases like side hustle tax, which is immediately like kicking down at people who are just trying to sell a few shirts on Vinted, just trying to sell an old pair of trainers? And why isn't it, you know, being labeled as like a potential way of cutting down on fraud, on counterfeit goods, all the stuff that, you know, the potentially web money is going into bad places?
They really don't do themselves any favors with these announcements, you know.
We're great. Your favorite platform will now have to tell the government right about your activity. Sounds dreadful. Where it's like, actually, we're easing your burden in terms of reporting your own taxes. It will be done through the platforms. It was already an outstanding rule that £1,000 was what you could make without being classed as self-employed. That hasn't been communicated. It sounds just like penalizing for penalizing's sake, when in fact it's, you know, it has its benefits. As Matt played devil's advocate, quite rightly, people can be totally annoyed about this. And, you know, it just seems to have been communicated so badly in terms of the impact it's going to have and who it's really aimed at.
Yeah. Going for the small guy is what it seems like if you were just to read, you know, the headlines or whatever, which anyone would be pissed at.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to get all existential and wide, I think that comes down to financial education growing up in this country. It's not necessarily taught how you can build a self-employed business, and if you're not necessarily taught that, how would you know about these, you know, these very, very vitally important thresholds that are in place but are obviously being reported that they don't currently exist and are part of this new legislation? But yeah, all the joys of government communications, etc. But yeah, coming back to that question in terms of how these new rules may possibly impact those platforms that don't directly facilitate the sales, such as classifieds websites. Mariam, what do you think on this one?
Yeah, again, I don't really take a particular stance, but the fact that, I mean, they kind of broadly defined it as digital platforms that facilitate the exchange of goods and services, which is exactly what Gumtree and Facebook Marketplace do. So I think it's only a matter of time until they also have to be sort of tax compliant, or however you want to say it. So my question is, like, how, in order to do this, there's obviously going to have to be like increased operational costs. So how does this sort of alter the user experience, obviously, and what does this do for advertisers? There's so many questions here, like how will this affect casual sellers versus more serious ones? What, there's obviously going to have to be price adjustments to account for like VAT. And ultimately, yeah, to play devil's advocate, what we're hoping for here is transparency. So will that be achieved? These are all sort of like questions that are in the air at the moment. So I guess only time will tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's probably where the government's coming from in terms of just bolstering that transparency. But yeah, in terms of whether that part, that cost will be passed on to the consumer or the platform, and therefore will we see more exodus towards the, you know, free classified platforms? John, what do you think on this one?
Yeah, in terms of where the cost gets passed down to the consumer,
probably
is the case.
Yippee!
But yes, definitely. If, you know, as we've discussed on the communication side, that will push people definitely towards the classifieds, towards, you know, away from the platforms. So yeah, it could alter the market a bit. If depends on how this is picked up, how this is taken by the general public and people who are selling on these platforms, but could certainly see. Other ways of e-commerce emerging. Just interesting for, yeah, the retail media question is fascinating for the ad spend that goes onto eBay, Depop, Vinted, etc.
Yeah, and I think it just to wrap this one up, it comes back to that scale question. I think in terms of the platforms that directly facilitate sales, over the past few years we've seen the commission payments you have to pay to those platforms when you're selling go up, and this could be just another nail in the coffin in terms of users migrating onto those free platforms. But at the same time, if those costs don't get passed on to the consumer, they could, in terms of the seller, they could remain on these platforms and, you know, increase the scale. We've seen obviously the sale of secondhand goods go up massively over the last few years during the cost of living crisis. So yeah, I think, to tie back to the first news story in terms of the streaming platforms and getting that balance right, again, I think it's getting that balance right here will be absolutely critical. But yeah, that just about draws us out of time for this first podcast of the year. John, it's been an absolute pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Matt. What a lovely start to the year.
And Mariam, thanks for introducing the famous new character, Animated Sponge, to the audience.
Glad to introduce. Thanks for having me, Matt. It's been great.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.